Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. This Thursday, a very historic day. Governor Rick Snyder announcing the appointment of Washington attorney and bankruptcy expert Kevin Orr as emergency financial manager for the city of Detroit. Talking this afternoon, Governor Snyder said he made this decision after what he called thoughtful and careful deliberation. On today's show, we take a look at the many things that will change in the city once it's under state control. We'll also talk with the emergency financial manager of Pontiac to get his view on really what needs to be done to fix Detroit's broken finances. And then we ask, is the city's financial crisis really fixable? We speak with columnist Daniel Howes, who says, don't take bankruptcy out of the equation. But first, we are joined now by Michigan Radio's Zoe Clark and Tracy Samilton, who have been covering this afternoon's big announcement. Tracy, I want to start with you, the governor appointing Washington attorney Kevin Orr. Tell us about him.
He is 54 years old. He is an African-American attorney. He has been in the bankruptcy field. He's a real hotshot in the restructuring field for almost 30 years, and that tells you something. He also helped to shepherd Chrysler through bankruptcy. So that kind of gives you a hint of why they are bringing this particular person in.
And certainly that whole bankruptcy procedure for Chrysler is seen as something that has just produced astounding results.
That's right. He has a track record of doing what people said couldn't be done. And when he spoke today, he said that. He said, you know, they said Chrysler couldn't go through bankruptcy in 42 days. It went through bankruptcy in 42 days.
And I want to add here, too, it was really interesting watching this announcement. Or had this sort of aura to him. He was ready to go. This was something that we've all talked about here, about that the person that Snyder chose couldn't be a wallflower. This could not be someone who couldn't handle the press, who couldn't handle the media, who's not going to be able to handle the city council.
Sure.
And Kevin Orr gets up there. I have to say, he looked like he was ready to go. I don't want to say he was enjoying it, but he was taking these questions from the media. He was answering them without hesitation.
So like his sleeves were rolled up.
He wasn't. He had this gorgeous suit on.
Yeah. Somebody
figuratively speaking.
He looked like he was ready to dive in, where you saw a little bit of a defeated looking Dave Bing, who was also next
and
to Snyder.
That's what I want to ask you about. So Dave Bing is there. What did he have to say at this historic announcement,
Well,
Zoe?
I mean, I think it's what he's been saying since the Governor Snyder made the announcement that we are going to see an emergency financial manager for the city, which was, look, it's not necessarily what any of us particularly want, but we have to say, okay. We had the hearing on Tuesday. Detroit City Council tried to appeal it. That was a no-go. So now we have this announcement, and Bing sort of just seems ready to step back. His physical presence looked like he was ready to take a step back and see if some fresh new blood outside of the state blood could come in and try to fix things.
And council's saying they're not going to challenge this either, correct? They're just going to let it be.
They are talking what sort of legal challenges they might have, but there's not anything they can do immediately.
So spell out now, just so we're all on the same page, what will Kevin Orr's role be going forward as he walks into City Hall in Detroit?
Well, he says his first priority is to maintain city services for the residents. That comes before anything else. And then his second one, and that's the big one, is dealing with this nearly more than $14 billion in bond obligations and pension obligations that the city really has no revenue stream coming in to deal with.
$327 million deficit.
Yes, running out of cash in a few months. It's a big deal.
And we'll talk later in the show, Cindy. Yes. You'll have some conversations with some folks who are going to lay out what they think, you know, Mr. Orr should be doing. So lots of opinions about what he needs to do first.
And what are you going to watch for, Zoe? What are you going to be looking for?
Oh, my gosh. Well, right now we've got the Financial Advisory Board sort of doing the official, okay, Orr is ready to go. I'm ready to just sort of see what he's going to dive into first. A lot of people think really what this is going to be is relationships. relationship building first, you know, making people within the city feel comfortable with him, like he is one of them instead of against them. We'll see how well he can do it. But like I said, looking at him today in this press conference, he seemed like he was ready to do all of the above.
And I would take it he's going to be a person that knows he's going to be facing criticism and resentment.
Yes, he is, I think, very clearly prepared for that. But he's taking a positive view of this, stressing his Michigan roots. So coming in, you know, really saying, hey, I really understand you guys.
Yes, because U of M undergrad and U of M law school, not a Michigan native, but educated here in Michigan.
Yeah. And in fact, Snyder said something about the two of them being at U of M around the same time. It doesn't sound like they know each other, but my guess is you will see the two of them sitting front and center at some U of M something sports games at some point soon together.
Zoe Clark and Tracy Samilton from Michigan Radio News, thanks so much for those insights. And we are continuing now because there is criticism, and we're joined now from Detroit by Tom Barrow. Tom Barrow twice ran for mayor of Detroit in the 1980s against Coleman Young and in 2009 against Dave Bing. And he has been a leading opponent of the appointment of an emergency financial manager for the city of Detroit. Tom Barrow joins us now from Detroit. Tom?
Hi.
Hi, Tom. Well, the appointment has been made, and Kevin Orr is the new emergency financial manager. So what do you see as your options now? How far would you go in trying to resist or protest this appointment?
Well, look, let me be candid. I mean, I don't think there's any secret that I believe this is all a fabrication and that there exists no emergency here in Detroit. And certainly you can't fix a balance sheet long-term debt doesn't create a short-term emergency. So I'm going to prophesize here that there will be no changes in any aspect of the long-term debt of the city of Detroit, with the exception of going back to pensioners and city employees to try to beat them down. Now, having said that, our organization is dedicated to resisting. It is not a matter that we don't want to cooperate and that sort of thing, but we're not going to capitulate to something that we know is phony. To start out with in the first place.
What does that mean, then, when you say that? We're not going to capitulate. So what does that mean for you and citizens for Detroit's future?
Yeah, let me put it this way. In our view, this is designed to get access to the city's assets. And I'm here to prophesy to you that they're going to transfer the water system to an authority. They're going to as a way to reduce debt, they're going to claim. But it has no impact on debt because they're not going to renegotiate with the bondholders. The treasurer's already told us that. So they're going to transfer the bus system to this new transportation authority. They're going to transfer the lighting system to this new lighting authority. They're going to transfer Belle Isle to another authority, as they did Cobo Hall. So what I see this is the surest way to try to get access to the city's assets by bypassing the elected officials, because this man, of course, he's even more of an outsider than Bing was. So I'm not, and I know our organization is committed to it, and we'll participate with a number of other groups. I mean, people are very angry about this. This is in essence a throwback to Jim Crow, creating unjust laws and then using them to essentially rob folks of that or prevent folks from doing. Because now, as you know, 50% of Michiganders are under an emergency manager. I mean, that's a terrible thing.
Let me ask you this, Tom Barrow. Do you feel Governor Snyder is being dishonest when he talks about a partnership and getting in and getting out? Is he not being honest?
Well, let me say this, and as I see it, the governor is disingenuous. I think he knows fully that there is no financial emergency here, that this is part of the plan. I think the governor is trained in finance, is untrained in finance. And I think the governor knows that this is the surest way to be able to achieve his objectives in terms of getting to the assets without having to fight with the city council and a mayor who has to return to their own communities. So, yes, I think he's disingenuous. I certainly do.
Tom, after we talked with you on the show a few weeks ago, for your first time on Stateside, we heard from some folks, and I want to ask, how would you respond to Detroiters who wrote to us and said, well, maybe the lights on Tom Barrow Street are working, but they sure aren't working on my street, and I'll take anybody over the way things are now. What do you say to those folks?
And I say to them that, you know, when your leadership fails you and then is complicitous, this is all part of a very well-orchestrated plan. You cannot tell me, nor can you tell a Detroiter who's willing to question, that every single light on a block is blown out. Every single light on a major street like East Jefferson is blown out. And every single light on Gratiot is blown out. Of course not. It's part of letting the devaluation of the city so that you can then make the argument that they're making now to make it more palatable to Detroiters who would normally be suspicious of this. And I see this. It's clear to me because I've seen the financial statements. I've seen the cash flow projections. I understand it all. And that's why we're not borrowing money from the state. The money that we drew down last year, that we got last year, we borrowed the $60 million, is still sitting up there. The Treasurer admitted it. And the general fund is generating excess revenues. No, they're not going to touch the bonded debt. I'm telling you now, you're going to see a major transfer and shifting of city assets into authorities. That's what this is really all about underneath.
Well, Tom Barrow, in our last minute, what can you tell us as far as what we might be seeing in terms of resistance or protests?
I think that, and I can tell you, I know that there are a number of community groups who see this as the modern-day civil rights movement, the taking of people's, while there may not be dogs out there, they're doing it in a very clever way by creating these financial emergencies to take over the cities. I'm told that there's going to be that resistance, and I can't tell you whether or not it's going to stop at the civil aspect or not. I would hope that it would, but I know that people are so excised about this taking up democracy that they're going to step out there.
Tom Barrow.
I'm sorry to say.
Tom Barrow is with Citizens for Detroit Future and possibly a mayoral candidate. Tom.
Well, we're going to make that decision at the beginning of April. We've brought folks together and we've been exploring, and now we're at the part of where we're about to make that decision.
Thanks for talking with us today on Stateside. Tom Barrow.
It's a pleasure.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Continuing our look at this historic day, the announcement by Governor Rick Snyder that Kevin Orr will become Detroit's emergency financial manager. Kevin Orr says he seeks one of the greatest turnarounds in the history of this country, the state's largest city under state control. Let's bring in Eric Scorsone now. He's a professor of economics at Michigan State University, and he's an expert in municipal finances and Michigan's emergency manager laws. Eric, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you.
Break it down for us and really help us understand the nuts and bolts. What will the EFM be able to do as he walks in City Hall in Detroit?
Well, I think the first thing they're going to need to do is understand the kind of total financial situation. You know, where are the problems? What are some of the pluses the city has? And I think giving a good handle on that. And the city has hired a number of consultants who are doing that kind of work. And so my assumption is they'll gather that information, try and see what the picture is. And then I think there'll be some expectation they'll need to make some quick successes in terms of probably better service delivery, particularly around public safety, maybe public lighting. And so those will be some short-term things. And then I think long-term they're going to have to look at pensions and health care and how do we make adjustments to those areas so the city can have long-term solvency as well.
And as the emergency financial manager, what power does that give this individual? So what can he do? What can't he do?
So they can certainly review all the books. They can review payroll. They can do the budget, which is the budget process is already underway for next year. They can also make changes to contracts, including union contracts. They can amend and even reject those. They can sell assets to some extent. They do have to get state approval for that. So they have pretty wide sweeping powers to do a lot of changes. Some of that's going to take time and going to require analysis to see what's the best approach. But they do have a lot of tools at their behest.
But then when the state's new EM law, PA 436, when it takes effect on March 28th and the EFM, Emergency Financial Manager, becomes an emergency manager, what changes then?
Right. So the emergency financial manager will be grandfathered in, as we call it, to become an emergency manager on March 28th when the new law, PA 436, kicks in. And basically, the EFMs that are currently in place don't have these contract powers. They did under the old law, PA 4, which was rejected in November. So now under PA 436, they will actually again have those powers to change and amend contracts. Another big difference that is very new is that the city council and the mayor, after 18 months, which would start on March 28th, could actually try and remove an emergency manager, and that is a new provision under the new law.
I have to ask you this because I know you're so deeply steeped in this law. And one of the persistent criticisms in reading letters to the editor and hearing sound bites from citizens even aimed at this whole appointment. And the fact is that the citizens of Michigan said no to the emergency manager law flat out last November. And critics view that the legislature came right back, wrote up another law, and then fixed it so there could be no referendum. And how does that not contravene the will of the voters?
Yeah, I think that's a very good question. I think the argument why it doesn't is because the city council or school board or whoever it may be in that case has a choice. They can go to a consent agreement, emergency manager, they can file bankruptcy directly, or they can do mediation. And then even within those choices, they then have other choices. And so the argument, I think, is that we've given choices. We still recognize there's a need for some, because there is financial crises that are occurring, and the state does have a obligation to oversee that, but they're trying to give choices within those constraints. And another example is a city council like Detroit City Council, if there's an emergency manager, can challenge the actions of the emergency manager on certain things, certain major decisions like a change to a union contract. And then, in essence, they can say, we have a different alternative. And there's a state loan board that would then decide which alternative is better. And the emergency manager would have to enact the proposal that the board decides on. So, they're, again, trying to give choices and options is, I think, the way it would respond to in terms of changes relative to PA4's rejection.
Eric Scorsone's, who we're speaking with, an economist with Michigan State University and an expert in municipal finances and the state's emergency manager law. Eric, is Detroit fixable under an emergency manager, in your opinion?
Yeah, I think Detroit is definitely fixable. I think it's going to take a number of years, but I think the city has a lot of assets. The city has a lot of revenue streams. I think if we have better tax collection, we'll have more revenues coming in. I think better spending controls can be imposed, and I think more budget discipline in general. And I think the emergency manager will have some tools to address some of these long-term legacy costs around the pension system and retiree health care. And those legacy costs are probably one of the most critical issues facing city government in Detroit and other cities in Michigan. So I think we can get to the pathway. I think it's going to take a number of years. And I think those solutions then allow the city to have more money to help provide current services like better lighting and more cops on the streets. So I think it's some bright news ahead, hopefully. It's going to be a tough challenge. There's going to be very tough decisions. But I think, hopefully Detroit will be able to turn the page soon.
What would be the first thing, perhaps even a mindset that you would advise this new emergency manager to have on day one?
Well, I would have a mindset that two things to me that are critical. One is this has to be long term. We can't just fix today's budget because in a way that's kind of easy to do. You can make some adjustments and cuts and balance the budget for fiscal year 14. But I think you have to look long-term. How do we make the city solvent for 10, 20 years out under very, say, conservative assumptions about revenues and spending? I think that's critical, number one. Number two, even though I know a lot of people feel like, democracy is being taken away, I would really recommend that the emergency manager reach out to the citizens of Detroit, hear their voice, what is their concerns? What are the critical public services that are needed? And which of those maybe can we, do away with? And so helping citizens kind of gauge where the city is, what is the true picture, and what services do we need to fund or not fund, and how do we best provide those services? And so I think that person needs to engage in that process so that eventually, we're going to have home rule restored, and I think that will help strengthen that home rule. And we've seen some of that in places like Flint, where I think that's been a pretty good model for this kind of process.
Eric, what's your thoughts as far as what this appointment and this historic, groundbreaking development, what does this mean for the state of Michigan as a whole?
Well, I try and look at it, in a positive way that I think we've come to realization of how serious the city of Detroit's problems are. and they've been building for many years. I think many of us know that, but I think this is a recognition maybe that we need some new solutions. I think the state is, I think the governor, as you said, I mean, partnering with the city to provide the resources needed. And I think all of us hope this emergency manager is, you know, obviously as short-term as possible so that the city can get back on its feet. But I think it's good to recognize the full scale of the problem now. And like I said, let's not only focus on short-term solutions. We need to make sure that the solutions in place are addressing those long-term costs, those unfunded liabilities, so that the city's viable for a long period of time. And so I certainly hope that's going to be the approach used.
And just what about economically speaking for the state of Michigan? Do you envision an impact? What does it mean economically?
Yeah, I think it does. I think we all know that Michigan and Detroit are tied together. People see them as, you know, maybe not synonymous, but similar at least. I think a more vibrant Detroit is going to be a better for the whole state. I think for those that don't live in Detroit, if we have a financially viable Detroit, it's going to be a partner to the private sector. I think the problem now is you're seeing new investment in Detroit. You're seeing some growth in downtown and midtown. But I think the city is kind of holding a lot of that back because of high taxes, poor service delivery, public safety issues. I think a vibrant, healthy city government becomes a strong partner that makes Detroit stronger. And I think that's good for Michigan. It's good for our economy. I mean, they're a big part of our state tax base that helps pay for schools. So I think it's in everyone's interest to really see this through. There's a lot of benefits.
Eric Scorsone, an economist with Michigan State University, and he's also an expert in the state's emergency manager law and municipal finances. Eric, thanks so much for talking with us today on Stateside.
Thank you.
We turn now to Lou Schimmel, who has a very, very long history of working in cities in Michigan dealing with financial crises. Schimmel is the former receiver of the City of Ecorse in the 1980s and the former emergency financial manager of Hamtramck. These days, he's the emergency financial manager of Pontiac. Lou, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you. Pleasure to be on your show.
So, Lou, the first question we have to ask, let's say it was you being handed this job, emergency financial manager of the city of Detroit. What is the very, very first thing that you would do?
There are two first things that I would do. In all cities where I've gone, and I'm sure other emergency managers, the two things that really hit you in the face as you walk in the door is the computer system, the controller system, the finance system, all of those areas, which are usually always antiquated. You need to get that in shape fairly quickly so that you know where you are. You need decent reporting. You need all of that whole area put together. So I would bring in someone under me that would be able to deal with all of that area, and just assign them that job and tell them to get it done. For example, in Detroit, I know that their system is legendary, you know, and it would have to be brought up to date. Then the other area is, like it or not, as an emergency manager, you're in court all the time. You're being sued all the time. Mm. It's a litigation delight for attorneys. And you need to have a very strong, your own very strong labor attorney and legal team to deal with all of those issues. So those are the first two people I'd be looking for as I came in the door in Detroit, is to get those two areas under control.
Okay. It's certainly no secret as far as the incredible challenges facing this new EM. I mean, when you think of the actual size, the fiscal problem seems unimaginable. In your view, how difficult will it be to accomplish a turnaround?
Well, this individual is going to have a lot of very good lieutenants because it is such an overwhelming, large job. Mm-hmm. So that's going to be the key, is getting very good people to be his assistants and assign them to designated areas and say, this is your area, this is what I expect you to clean up. And I believe if you take that approach, you will certainly be able to take the present situation and make it much better.
We We have to address, I think, Lou, one of the persistent criticisms that I'm sure you have heard again and again in your tenure, but particularly lately because of the way the whole political story played out. So one of the persistent criticisms aimed at the appointment of an EM, the fact that the citizens of Michigan rejected the emergency manager law last November. They said no. And then the critics' view is the legislature came right back and wrote up another EM law and then fixed it so there can be no citizen referendum. So the question is, how does that not contravene the will of the voters? How do you answer that?
Well, I think really, Cynthia, you have three things that you can do in Detroit or anywhere else that's in that kind of situation. Number one is you can do nothing. And by doing nothing, you just end up sending more and more money. And it gets squandered away and nothing changes. I think citizens have to look at that and say, you know, we're not happy with that. The other is you can send in an emergency manager and the emergency manager will be criticized just like you have just described. And thirdly, you can say, all right, we won't do either one of those and simply go straight to bankruptcy and let a bankruptcy judge take care of the whole situation. I happen to feel the emergency manager should be tried and used. It's better than the other two alternatives. And I believe the state of Michigan has a duty to see that its municipalities are not run like Detroit is run. And I think the only option is the emergency manager that's any better than the other two.
Lou Schimmel, in your view, is Detroit fixable?
Detroit's fixable. Detroit's fixable. It may be a situation where it involves similar to what happened to General Motors, which you might have a structured bankruptcy as part of the formula, but it certainly is fixable, and it needs to get fixed so that it can turn around like I claim we're doing in the city of Pontiac.
And how long do you think it would take?
You know, it's hard to say till you get your feet on the ground and get going as to how long it will take, but it certainly is not going to go that quickly. I mean, just because of the massive amount of work that needs to be done. But if you, as I say, work in the structured bankruptcy, it would probably go quicker than if you didn't. And it's going to take years, though. I can't tell you how many years, but you can't get it done. You can't get it done in a year or two, I don't think. In my opinion, it has to be in the five-year range at least.
And Lou, finally, just what would you be watching for? What should we be watching for? What would be some benchmarks that this is working and things are improving?
Well, I think at the beginning, people will be very critical and it'll be very difficult to get started. But I think as you go down the line and things get changed and begin to happen, then you'll feel better about it. But up front, I think it's going to be, you know, a hard day walking into City Hall. But I think it'll improve, and I think it'll improve as the months tick off.
Lou Schimmel, Emergency Manager of Pontiac, and we thank you very much for talking with us today on Stateside.
Been a pleasure.
And the word from Lansing is the next piece is in place. The Michigan Emergency Loan Board has approved the hiring of Kevin Orr as Detroit's EM. His annual salary, $275,000, and his starting date is March 25th. And the Detroit City Council will not legally challenge the appointment of Kevin Orr. That comes from Council President Charles Pugh. Meantime, state lawmakers who represent Detroit are having mixed reactions to the announcement. Senator Coleman Young II, of course, the son of the former Detroit mayor, blasted Governor Snyder at the end of today's state Senate session. He accused Snyder of, quote, wiping out elected officials at the expense of what he calls fiscal austerity. But another Detroit Democrat, Senator Tupac Hunter, says he's disappointed Detroit city leaders didn't do more to avoid this day. Hunter says he doesn't like the emergency manager law, and he expects the city council will fight Snyder's decision for political reasons. But at the end of the day, Senator Tupac Hunter says residents want someone to turn on broken streetlights, clean up parks, and improve what he calls horrible city services. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. We've been talking through this hour about what Kevin Orr's appointment might mean when he first takes over the new emergency manager for Detroit. Daniel Howes, business columnist at the Detroit News, joins us now as he does most weeks. Daniel, in your column today, you write about bankruptcy as a next step, even after the appointment of an emergency manager. So how is a bankruptcy for a big city different from a business or a personal bankruptcy?
Well, there's a number of differences, and I think listeners need to understand that Chapter 9 bankruptcy has almost never been used in the Sixth Circuit, of which Michigan is one of four states. So we're really, the federal judges who sit on the bankruptcy court would be essentially plowing new ground. A couple of things that are really important. You hear people talking about selling of assets and that people, the city can be forced to sell assets to pay off creditors, who would include, by the way, pension funds of their own employees and retirees. Under Chapter 9, my understanding is that creditors cannot force the sale of any asset that is owned by the city. Only the city can propose to sell certain assets to turn them into cash. So that's one very big difference. The other thing is that you're talking about a sovereign state here, essentially, because, again, people need to understand there's no such thing as a sovereign city. Detroit is not a sovereign city. The only thing sovereign is the state of Michigan. And any city, township, municipality exists at the pleasure, essentially, of the chief executive or of the state, which is why the governor, one of the things that underpins the power to do certain things and to step in when the financial situation gets bad. And as we go forward here, you're also going to see, I think, if we get into Chapter 9, that the 10th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution limits what a federal official can do to a sovereign state. So a judge typically will, as it's been explained to me, rule upon what is brought to him or her. He will not be issuing orders from the bench about certain things that have to happen. He will be issuing orders based upon what is put before him. And the person or persons that is putting something before him is the representative of the debtor, which would probably be the emergency manager. Mm. If you didn't have an emergency manager, it may be, say, the city council or the mayor of the city. So he rules on a situation like that. Now, in the context of my column today, I think what we have here is the emergency manager will be able to do and start to address some real key financial problems facing the city and operational ones. But there are certain things that he probably will not be able to do, and one of the biggest is negotiate and or change pensions that are already vested with retirees. That can be done by a bankruptcy court, and there's been some precedent for it in Rhode Island and some other things where people who've already vested and are already drawing their pensions have been ruled that they have to give up a portion of those pensions. That was in Rhode Island. Now, the state laws in each state can be different. So this is really kind of uncharted territory in terms of how the federal judge who has to keep an eye on the 10th Amendment, what he is able to do vis-a-vis pensions. But I think one of the senses that we got from talking with Eric Scorsone at Michigan State is that if the estimates of the unfunded status of these pension funds is as bad as some of the estimates seem to suggest that it is, mm-hmm. Detroit may not be able to get where it needs to go outside of bankruptcy. Now, I think a lot of experts will tell you that an emergency manager can do a lot that a bankruptcy court could do outside of bankruptcy, but he can't do everything. And I think that's why my sense is that this may be the first step, or that he may be the warm-up act for the main event, which would be a Chapter 9, the largest in American history.
What do you think the stigma would be, and how would it affect the feeling of the city if there is a structured bankruptcy?
Well, we know what the stigma would be, and I think a lot of people have been arguing for some time that Detroit already is bankrupt. This would just be confirmation of it. I think the people in the business community see this as a positive. I've had some people suggest to me that this is what we're talking about here is a technical process. The private sector is investing more and more in the city, foundations, companies. I think that's because they see that conditions are changing. I think Dave Bing has been a bit ineffective as a manager, but I think he's also clearly changed the tone at City Hall. There was a real exclamation point put on that this week with the conviction of Kwame Kilpatrick and others that maybe we're moving into another time here, and I think people are hopeful that that is the case. Will there be a stigma? Of course there will be. But, you know, New York had its problems in the 70s. Cleveland had its problem in the late 70s. Now, they didn't go to bankruptcy and they didn't go to Chapter 9, but they've pushed beyond that and have rehabilitated themselves, particularly the city of New York. I think it can get better. It's not going to be this isn't a destination so much as it is a process.
Okay.
And I think you have a lot of people that are very impatient and think that we can have one solution. I don't think that's going to happen.
What would it feel like, do you think, if you're a resident, you are living in the city of Detroit, you call it home, what would a Chapter 9 bankruptcy feel like for you?
I don't think we really know that yet, because I think there'll be some things that will happen before that. And the governor is well aware of the fact that this process is going to require some early wins, some things that people can see. You know, going and renegotiating with pension funds and bondholders on payment schedules is not something that the average resident of Detroit can see. What they can see is if the lights go on. What they can see is if the garbage gets picked up on time. So I think what you're going to have is an emergency manager who's going to focus on tangible things that can improve the lives of average Detroiters. The other thing they can do at the same time is those financial renegotiations with creditors. They can do that, but that's not something that's as tangible to the average Detroiter as just the basics of city services. And as far as Chapter 9, that I think is going to be later in the process. And under Michigan law, the way that would work is the emergency manager would go to the governor and say, my plan is not achievable. Mm-hmm. We can't get there but for a Chapter 9 filing. It's not a foregone conclusion that it has to happen, but I think experts who look at this think that some of the real big knotty issues, our only way they can manage them is in a federal courtroom.
Daniel Howes, business columnist from the Detroit News, joining us each week, and appreciate your time this time, Daniel. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. How about a story?
Everybody's got a story. Some are very extraordinary stories. It might be good for somebody to look into theirs.
Because a story is the shortest distance between two people.
Allison Downey curates stories for our ongoing series, The Living Room.
So, St. Paddy's Day is around the corner, and it's always been a really special day for me because I'm Irish-American. My great-great-grandparents came over on the boat from County Wexford and County Cork to New York City, like so many other Irish. But I've got my friend Yvonne Healy here today, and she's really an Irish-American. I mean, born in Ireland, now a U.S. citizen living in Michigan. So I've asked her to tell us the story of her journey to becoming an Irish-American storyteller.
When I was little, the people in Ireland called me Itagajir, which means that I was between the two worlds, because I was between the two worlds of Ireland and the United States. In the United States, they called me an immigrant. And I was an immigrant in Pennsylvania in the 1950s. Our home was like crossing over a border and entering a different country, because we spoke Irish Gaelic in the home. We had very Irish manners. We ate Irish food. We didn't really watch TV that much, but we'd have this big open space in the front hall where Mom would teach us reels and jigs. There were four kids, so we had plenty of people for dancing and singing around the piano with my dad. And he'd always sing Danny Boy in Irish. He always said everything in Irish. Sometimes he would sit me down and he would tell me those old Irish stories. He would pass along stories that people had given him. And I would have to repeat it after him, line by line, so that I got it just right, the way it had been told with his family for who knows how long. Then if I got it right, he would say, shin, shin, shine, which is, and that is that. That's how the Irish end the story. And then when I went to school, it was completely different. The worst was St. Patrick's Day, because on St. Patrick's Day, we were the token Irish, and we had to bring a program of Irish culture for every single room in that school. But the thing was, they didn't really want Irish culture. They wanted the Hollywood version of Irish culture. So instead of the songs we sang at home, we were singing Tora Laura Laura, like Bing Crosby, and it's actually not Irish at all. And then will come the questions, and the questions were always really stupid. What's so special about the four-leaf clover? And I'd say it's a shamrock, three leaves. And, oh, gosh, I really, really, really hated when somebody would ask me, how many six-packs does your dad drink on Saturday night? And does your mom smoke a pipe? They didn't know my parents. My family didn't drink. My family didn't smoke. We were Irish. We went to church. But I knew that they were trying to hurt me when they said that. But then the teacher would give me like a Clark bar, which was like the best candy of all. And then I'd go off to the other rooms. I hated St. Patrick's Day. But this was all going to change someday. In fact, it was going to change the day that I was naturalized. When I was in third grade, I got the day off of school. And it was a very big deal because this is why we had come to the United States. This is why I grew up without my granny and without my litter of cousins and without my uncles. And I figured I wasn't going to have any more freckles. And we go all the way into Pittsburgh. And my dad is always singing and humming in the car. But at one point he stops and he's like, you know, after today, you're going to be American citizens. You're going to have the freedom to be anyone you want to be able to live anywhere you want to live. As long as I could remember, this was what we were living for, to become Americans. We went into the federal building in Pittsburgh, and we each had to go separately because we were getting our separate papers, and I knew there was going to be a test. And so I went in, and there I was with this judge, the stranger, and I was just a little kid. And he asked me these questions. Who's the president of the United States? And I said, General Dwight D. Eisenhower. And then he said, and this is kind of a tricky question, how many states are there? And it was a tricky question because it was the only time in history where the answer was 49 because Alaska had just gotten in and Hawaii was just about to make it. And then he said, congratulations, now you're going to repeat the Oath of Allegiance after me word for word. And I could do that because I'd been repeating with my dad. And he said, don't worry about these big words. It just means that from now on you're American and you won't be Irish anymore. Well, that had never occurred to me. But I was an obedient child, so I repeated line after line. And you say, congratulations, you're American. Then I had a smile that went from one side of my head to the other, even with my gap teeth. Not much changed when I became American. My freckles were still all over my face. But my parents stopped speaking Irish to us. In fact, we were forbidden to speak Irish. We had to be Americans. We had to blend in. And my Irish fell away. But I kept my accent for a little while until someone decided that I needed to lose it. My teacher, Sister Mary Scary Meany, she said to me one day, you know, you're going to learn how to speak like a real American. And she pulled out a chair and she said, get up on that chair. And she said, you have to harden your R's. Say after me, Tony Tiger. And I said, Tony Tiger? Tiger. Tiger. No, you're an American. Harden that R. And she was getting frustrated. So she picked up a book and I was getting frustrated, so I started crying, and then the book hit me, and I cried some more, and the book hit me again and again, and I cried a lot more. And they sent me down to the office, and they couldn't stop me crying, and my mother tells me that she was standing outside of the house talking to one of the neighbors when she looked up, and over the crest of the hill in the middle of the day came her little 8-year-old girl sobbing in hysterics. And she put her arms around me, but I couldn't stop crying. She didn't know what to do. She hit me, and I stopped crying. And I started stuttering. Well, stuttering was not okay with my parents because it wouldn't make me sound like a real American, and it certainly wasn't an Irish value. So my parents enrolled me in an acting class, and I loved it. It was wonderful. I stopped stuttering, and I started speaking with all these different voices. And
I kept pursuing it, and eventually I got to speak like a Greek Medea or a Scottish Lady Macbeth, and then I was a nurse on TV as an adult, and I was off-Broadway actress, and I was speaking in all these different voices, but not my own. And then I became, best roles of all, I became a wife and a mother. And when I had kids then, they led me back to my love of story as a kid, listening to my dad's stories, and I discovered I was a storyteller. But I was telling American stories, you know, what I thought they wanted to hear, the Three Little Pigs, stories about the American Revolution. So we were living in New York City, but then we had kids, and that makes you think about things in a way different way. So we started thinking about changing our lives, just like my dad had changed his life. And we headed out here to Michigan to create a new life for ourselves, the one we wanted for us and for our children. A grant application came across my desk from the Michigan Humanities Council that asked, what's unique about me as an artist that I was able to say, well, I'm Irish. And that's when I realized that while I had reclaimed my voice, I had never reclaimed my identity. So I started studying Irish Gaelic, and I started studying Irish history, and I told Irish and Irish American stories, and that's something that I received as a gift here in Michigan. So now, Ishgaili, I'm a storyteller. Is Madanakme, I'm American. Is Adanakme, I'm Irish. Is Michigandnakme, and I'm a Michigander. Shin, shin, shine, and that is that.
Yvonne Healy is a Michigan-based Irish-American storyteller. This piece was developed by Allison Downey, and it was produced by Allison and Zach Rosen. To learn more about Yvonne Healy and hear an original Irish Ireland themed song by Allison Downey, you can visit our website, michiganradio.org. And that wraps up Stateside for this week. We will talk to you again at 3 on Monday afternoon, the day after St. Patrick's Day. And with that in mind, I just felt that speaking as someone who has gone to school in Cork, Ireland, who married a man from Cork, who has lived her past 40 years with one foot in Michigan and one foot in Cork, it was fitting to end this week with a bit of Irish. La Féile Pádraic de Gach Aine, a happy St. Patrick's Day to all. Thanks so much for listening.